your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Valentine's Day. Every year around this time, into my inbox comes the latest survey on romance in the workplace. And this year is no exception, and it's been interesting over the years to notice the real change in how much office romance happens. I want to share with you what we just got, what I just got in the email. It's called the Vault 2019 Office Romance Survey. They surveyed over 700 people, and guess what percentage of those respondents have engaged in an office romance? Over half, 58%. And of course, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, with everybody busier, and while, you know, certainly online dating of various sorts has made a big difference, it's still, when you see somebody day in and day out in the workplace, it allows a real relationship to slowly blossom. But that surprised me. 58% of those surveyed have had an office romance. And this was the even more interesting. When those 700-plus people were asked if they've intentionally avoided office romance, because after all, we're hearing every day is, you know, you're going to get sued, and especially in the Me Too era, and the power imbalances, and you don't want to let the coworkers know because it could, you know, make it appear there's favoritism. Guess what percentage of people intentionally avoided office romances? Only 37%. In other words, 63% are open to office romances. And here is a couple of quotes from the survey. There was an open-ended questions, apparently. This is one quote. I like this one. Every fiber of my being tells me, don't pursue office romances. And yet every time I'm in a situation when I feel there may be a connection, I don't cut it off. That's a quote. And somebody who's a little more restrained on the other end of the continuum, this quote starts, a coworker and I were mutually attracted, but I was concerned that if we connected and then broke up, it would permanently damage my standing in the organization. It was a small, well-networked organization where coworkers and management needed to think well of you if you wanted to get anything done, so I let it alone. There's the kind of the continuum. And lest this merely be a third-party abstract discussion, with me on the line to describe how we met, which is definitely office romance, as you'll hear in a moment, Dr. Barbara Nemko. Tell the story.
I was a teacher in a junior high school, and I'd been there for a number of years, and Marty was hired to do drug counseling and prevention classes with kids in the school. And so I come into the teacher's cafeteria and see him sitting there with his head falling into his teacup, always looking depressed. And I would...
For good reason. I mean, the kids were, to use the current word, were challenging.
Yeah, they were. But I'd been there long enough that I pretty much knew how to handle them. And you looked so sad. So I started a conversation just because he was a new person in the building and I wanted to be nice.
You mean it wasn't because I was handsome and gorgeous and you had to talk to me? Because I was new?
You're right. It was because you were handsome and gorgeous and I had to talk to you.
Right. Continue.
So we ended up having coffee or lunch together in the teacher's lunchroom a number of times, and he was pretty interesting. So I decided, I like him. And how am I going to get him to ask me out? I know. I'll have a party and I'll invite him. So I invited him to this non-existent party that was only in my head, because if he had said no, then there wouldn't have been any. But he accepted. So then I had a scrounge around and find a couple of people to invite to the party, and as they say, the rest is history.
Yep. Now, could you imagine, Barbara, let's say, you know, it was now 2019, and in many workplaces there is at least a discouragement, if not an out-and-out rule, precluding office romances. We would have probably never met, and who knows if we would have been happier or sadder.
I think that's more in private businesses than it is in public, because the whole notion of that you're going to get let go if something goes wrong, that doesn't happen in a public agency where you have all kinds of due process and they would have to have a reason, and the reason couldn't be that you were had been in a relationship with somebody else who works there.
And really, when you think about it,
mm-hmm. why wouldn't the workplace be
the perfect place
to meet somebody? It's just so silly. And if you're in a place where you're interacting all day with a number of people and there's an attraction between mm-hmm. you and one of those other people, you're not going to just turn it off. That's silly. Mm-hmm. You see them all the time, and it tends to grow over time.
But there's a conflict between what is best in the couple's interest and the workplace. There's no question
right.
that it's the right place to meet somebody, because you see them on a long-term basis. Little by little, you can get to know each other, and not an artificial, you know, bar or rave environment. But from the workplace perspective, there can be so much accusations of favoritism. Very often, if the lovey-dovey couple is diving into the supply room, you know, it inhibits the work getting done. And of course, you know, these days we know if there's a power imbalance, sleeping with a boss, you've got sexual harassment lawsuits, not just against the person, but against the entire workplace. So there is a built-in tension between what is best for the individuals and what is best for the organization, business or nonprofit or government agency. Isn't that fair?
Absolutely true, but it's the individuals who are going to decide whether to stop this or let it continue.
Well, unless, like I said, there's many workplaces that have rules. But in any case, I like stories, and especially when we're dealing with something fun for a change, not like work and unemployment and being treated poorly and harassment and all the rest of it. This is a good time for stories. It's Valentine's Day. So, dear listeners, would you like to tell your story about your office romance? The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Barbara, you run a 200-person office. What policy do you have in regard, if any, regarding office romance? And if you had your druthers and you didn't have to deal with 9 zillion layers of governmental regulations, what would be the rule that you would initiate?
I don't think I would have a rule. I think if I saw someone involved with somebody and there was a power imbalance, I might talk to them about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that I would make a rule, given that I already violated it 40 years ago.
Well, you weren't my boss, but I mean, I'm...
Exactly. I mean,
but
most
I mean,
of
you
the
said
people
power imbalance.
That Let's... I have in my office are basically colleagues rather
yeah.
than... You know, people. That's why I said if there's a power imbalance, that's when I would talk to them.
I would do more than talk. I would have that. Would if I were in charge, I would have one rule and one guideline. My rule is absolutely no romantic relations between boss and supervisee. There is just too many things that can go wrong. Accusations of favoritism. If the relationship doesn't work out, there can be all kinds of retribution. No, that's got to be a no-no. But that's only a relatively small percentage of the relationships that could exist in the workplace.
Well,
let me finish. And there I would simply say, I advise you to exercise due caution and please try to be professional in the workplace. But I fully recognize that it's a wonderful place to meet a romantic partner. That would be my rule. Now, what were you going to say, Barb?
Suppose you see that there is an attraction. People always think that they can
sure.
hide that. But
no,
you see there is
course.
An attraction.
Sure.
And one is the boss and one is the supervisee.
Okay.
And you have a rule.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still working there and you can still see the attraction.
Oh, well, I would not say that. You can't presume that they're just because somebody looks at somebody in a kind of a flirtatious way. I mean, that's micromanaging. It's only as if it was clear that there was a relationship. I would have a rule prohibiting it. But of
what
course,
would make it clear? I mean, how do you make the rule? Do they have to live together? Do
no.
you have to see them holding hands? I mean, how do you go beyond,
hard to
I
say.
Can tell they have a relationship... To I see it so much that I have to do something.
Certainly not looking, but if I mean, again, there is a privacy issue too. But if there is, if for example, they've ducked into the diving closet and I'm hearing moaning noises, and it's been known to happen.
Yeah.
You know, that would be evidence. Or let's say that, you know, very often it's very hard to keep secret that romantic relationship. So the boss is, you know, during the break telling one of the other workers, boy, I really love Mary. She's just amazing. We're having, you know, that can, and then the worker comes to me and says, you know, John was talking about how he's really hot for Mary and the great relationship. That's when I would, I probably, if the person, you know, everything is gray area. I hate black and white rules. So if the person was a great employee, let's say his boss was great, and it really seemed like both parties were getting their work done, I probably would issue a warning to say there will be absolutely no, I don't know, you know, I think I'd have to talk to legal, because I could get in trouble as the employer. I could lose a fortune if I am allowed a power imbalanced relationship, and either an aggrieved party in the breakup or one of the coworkers talks about hostile environment. I would have to talk to legal. I think the power imbalance thing is, this is 2019. This is not 1980. And so I think I would have to be really, really careful and get my advice from legal counsel on this, so I didn't feel like I was just shooting from the hip. Anyway, that's getting too mean and serious. I hate that part of the discussion. So we have a call. Let's go to the phones and let's hopefully hear a more upbeat story. But the truth is what we care about. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. It's your turn on the air. Tell us about your experience with a romance in the workplace.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Marty and Barbara. It's been a few years since I've called in, but my name's Raja, and my story is, it was sort of an untraditional working arrangement that led to my meeting my wife of 20-something years now. I was actually technically unemployed and living in a basement of two professors at UC Berkeley, but the arrangement was I could live there without paying rent, as long as I ran errands for them and helped them at social occasions. And so one of them called me and said, you know, I need you to ship some books for me. And they're actually videotapes. So I went down to UC Berkeley, and my now wife had just graduated from...
Wait, I'm not hearing you. You've cut out. My wife, after the word, my wife, I have heard nothing. Have I lost you?
Professor, the male professor.
No, I'm sorry. You cut out right after the words "my wife." Can you go back about, press rewind on your speaking for about 5 or 10 seconds?
Oh, sure. Can you hear me now? Okay.
Yes, I do.
Okay, so it was an untraditional sort of working arrangement in the sense.
I heard that. I knew you were in the basement. You were living in the basement. He sent you on an errand, and then you said your wife.
Oh yeah. So she was working as a secretary, a new Cal. She's working as secretary in that department, which was the South Asian department, UC Berkeley. And so she helped me look for a box to ship the videotapes. And I went back to my basement apartment. I called the professor in that couple, and I asked him, you know, is she, you know, dating someone or seeing someone? And he said, I don't know, I'll find out. And then he hung up, and he called a bunch of the other professors and did some research and reconnaissance, and then got back to me and said, no, I don't know why, but she's not seeing anyone. And so one thing led to another, and... that's how I met her, and actually I was out of work for a couple of months, and it actually gave me an opportunity to get to know her, which I may not have been able to do if I'd been gainfully employed. So sometimes when you're out of work and just trying to survive, those are the best times to have an opportunity.
Well, that's an out-of-the-box way to meet somebody.
I like the fact that you had all this help in figuring out whether or not she was seeing someone.
Well, we've all heard that UC Berkeley was a research university, but this gives a whole new meaning to that. Anyway.
Good point.
Especially because your connection is stuck, so I'm going to let you go. Thanks for calling Work with Marty and Barbara, though.
All right, thank you.
All right, enough of this. Let's turn to topic two. And the topic two is what I promoted all week, but I figured it was Valentine's Day. We really should at least give a little tip of the cap to that. One of the simpler green businesses that one can start is a consignment store. It's when you're selling the owner's used products. The store owner doesn't own the product. The owner just drops off the product at the store. It could usually clothing or furniture or craft items or even cars. And the shop owner takes the items that he or doesn't accept everything, but it takes the items that he or she thinks are going to sell, tries to sell them at fair market, you know, use price value, and then splits the money, usually 50-50 or something like that. And voila, you've got product recycling in action. And as is the case with my guest, and I don't mean Barbara, I'm going to be introducing another guest in a minute. If the owner of the clothing, the person who owns the dress or whatever, agrees to donate the proceeds, the money that the storekeeper got, agrees to donate it to charity, that owner of the former owner now of the dress gets a tax deduction. So it's like win. And with me and with Barbara to discuss what it's really like to own a consignment shop now in her 22nd year as the hands-on owner. She likes to call herself the proprietress of Lolo's, a St. Helena women's clothing consignment shop. Christine Waldenberg, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Marty.
Great. And in part because clothing, men's nor women's, is something I know much about or frankly care much about, here to jump in with the questions and comments is someone who does care about clothing, the aforementioned wife, who, by the way, I might say, actually bought a $1,000 St. John designer dress for $70 at a consignment shop. Barbara.
Such a deal.
Right, it was a deal, right? Is it true, Barbara, or am I exaggerating?
No, that's true. It was probably 30 years ago, but yes, it's true.
We looked it up on the internet. It was still their internet time, and it was the list price on the St. John's website was $990, and we bought it for $70 on Piedmont Avenue at a sophisticated lady was the name of, I can't believe I remember that, sophisticated lady consignment shop on Piedmont Avenue. But anyway, Christine.
Yes.
What is something that might surprise me, or even Barb, about running a consignment store?
I thought about that a lot, and I think that as opposed to traditional retail, it's a very emotional business because you are dealing with things that don't belong to you. They belong to other people. Mm. They were given them, or they purchased them, or they acquired them in some way. And so they have an attachment. So you have to figure out what their attachment is and, you know, let them let it go. And so as a result of that, you deal with a lot of different personalities, some good, some bad. But it's always interesting. It's always a little like Christmas.
Tell me about, yeah, it's like Christmas because you're all getting these presents. But tell me, does a particular customer or customer with a particular item that you had to use that emotional psychology to get her to part with it?
Well, it happens all the time, really. Mm. A lot of it is sort of figuring out where they're coming from. By the time they've walked in the door with the item, they've pretty much decided that they want to let it
go.
But
if
there's any kind of hesitation, you can feel it. And I always urge them not to sell it or not to try it because they really do want it, and you know that. So take it back. I don't care one way or the other if they sell it. So let them hold on to it.
But Christine,
sometimes there's a lot of sentimental value to things.
Yes.
There's not physical value, but a lot of sentimental.
So multiple choice. I can either role play and pretend I have this dress that has sentimental value to me, and you can talk to me. We'll role play it right here. Or you can tell me about some person who had an item with sentimental value. Which do you want to do?
You could role play me. That'd be fine.
Okay, fine. So, you know, I have this beautiful dress that I wore to my daughter's wedding. And it really looked great. Unfortunately, I gained a few pounds, and I can't. Hopefully, my daughter will never get married again. So, for both of those reasons, and it was very expensive when I got it. It was a typical bridezilla mother of the bride dress, it seems a shame to have it sit in the closet, and we could use the money. So, I'm thinking I probably should consign it to you.
Oh, well, but so tell me about the wedding. Tell me a little bit more about that day.
Oh, it was beautiful. I love the couple. We did it at Berenger's in Napa, and they really look like they're meant for each other. And, you know,
oh, it must have been absolutely beautiful.
It was beautiful. It was now 2 years ago, and they're still, I've seen their friends are getting divorced all left and right, but my daughter and her husband are still together. They're wonderful.
Well, it sounds like that you have a lovely family. Now, do you, so you say the dress no longer fits you.
I should lose weight.
Well, I have found with a lot of people that if you say that, it doesn't necessarily happen. So that isn't a good enough reason to hang on to something.
No, I keep going up and down.
Tell me a little bit about, tell me how much it cost originally.
I'm embarrassed to tell you, it cost me $1,800.
Okay. Well, just to let you know how we price things, I would probably put a quarter to a third of that value on the dress. So, you know, if we put $600 on it and we sold it for that price, you would make $300. But after it's been in my store for 45 days, we reduce it to half price. So then it would sell for $100. It would sell for $300, and you would make $150. So I don't know if that's enough, if that's the kind of money you had in mind or not. And if it is, great. If it isn't, then, you know, then you can take it back to your home and remember that your daughter's beautiful wedding.
Christine, how likely do you think it'll sell for $600 or for $300? And is it possible that, and it would be so embarrassing, if it kept sitting there for 90 days and it didn't sell, you'd probably donate it to charity and it would be worth zero.
Well, that is what we do. If something goes beyond its consignment time and if you don't come and pick it up by a certain date, which I would tell you, then that is what would happen to it. So that's the good news and the bad news. So it could leave your life in that way as well. And then somebody else might be able to enjoy it. You have to think of it in terms of somebody else being able to enjoy it, but also the right person with the right size needing a beautiful blue dress to wear to a specific event has to walk in the door in that period of time. And that may or may not happen.
Christine, thank you.
It has nothing to do with the dress. It's about who walks in and who needs or wants to buy it.
Christine, I really appreciate you playing with me in that role play. That really gave us a window into what it's really like in the trenches and can explain.
Sometimes it really is the trenches, that's for sure.
Was I realistic? Was that at all realistic or was I being melodramatic?
No, you were being melodramatic. It happens that way because people think they want to get rid of something, but they might have an overinflated view of how much it's really worth.
Well, exactly. That's why Barbara got the $1,000 St. John's dress for $70.
Right, because she walked in the door at the right time, at the right place, and it fit her, and it probably wouldn't have fit anybody else because she's really tiny.
Right.
And there, it was waiting for her.
Right. Okay. Let's turn to you, to the moment. There is always in every person's life a moment they've either choose their career or decide to start the business. Was there a moment that you, Christine Waldenberg, decided to start Lolo's, the consignment shop in St. Helena? Was there a moment you decided to pull the trigger, rent the space, buy the inventory?
Well, it came more slowly than that. I had a small child, and I was a single mom, and I discovered the secondary market, used toys, used clothes for kids, because it's, you know, if you don't have a whole lot of money, it's the best way to do things, because, first of all, the kid doesn't know if it's new or used.
Right.
They don't really care.
Right.
And the other point of it is that if you're on a budget, it's a great way to do things. Let alone the, you know, green part of it and, you know, just the fact that you're recycling and not buying something brand new. So I had written a business plan for a children's consignment store originally and put it on the shelf for a few years because I really didn't have the means to be able to do that. And so my mother passed away and I was left a little bit of money, and so I was able to start thinking about that business plan, pulled it off the shelf, redid it, realizing that you have to sell a whole lot of $2 items to be able to make that business plan work, so I expanded it to include women's, men's, and furniture, as well as kids. And so I saw this adorable
store in St. Helena, where I had just moved to, and said, that's it. That's the store. That's the place. And it was. So it wasn't that difficult. The one good thing about the consignment business as opposed to traditional retail, again, is that you don't buy
right.
an inventory.
Right.
You only pay for the inventory if you sell it.
Right.
If you don't sell it, it goes back to the person who brought it in, or it gets donated. So there isn't a huge cash outlay.
But was it scary at all? I mean, I would think that's all true, and that's absolutely critical. That's the big difference between any other retail store and a consignment store. Yeah, there's much less, they don't need the inventory. But the rent on a cute little place in St. Helena ain't chopped liver. Were you nervous about having to sign that lease?
I'm sure I was. I don't remember it at this point, but I think I remember being more giddy with excitement that I owned a business, and that, you know, every day, you know, you'd be a little scared about it. I think I remember saying to my friend that I opened the doors and somebody came in and bought something, and I was astounded. So
right.
from that point forward, it just sort of snowballed. It's it was very gratifying.
It's 22 years later. You still giddy when you go into work?
Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes it can be, for sure, because there's a wonderful community that I work in. When you are in a place for 22, going on 23 years, you see women that are pregnant, and then they give birth, and then they have kids, and then their kids go to college, and you get to watch that whole cycle, as well as people dying as well. I mean, there's people that are no longer there. So you get this sense of a community, and also the people that come into your store get a slice of that life also. So the Napa Valley is wealthy. It has a lot of second homeowners as well as first homeowners that have beautiful things. And so you get a real slice of what goes on in a place when you visit a community in their consignment stores or their thrift stores.
That's actually one of the benefits of a consignment store. Forget about just the green or the rewarding experience. You know, there are a lot of people who don't have much money who, instead of having to buy really crappy clothes, let's say at Walmart, can
right.
come and get something at a consignment store that they wouldn't have otherwise dreamed of and get it. It's very often, if you wait for the sales, for 10% or 20% of what it would cost.
Oh, absolutely. It's a great deal. And the clothing that, I mean, people still will, we consign disposable clothing as well. You know, not Walmart necessarily, but other teen brands that aren't very expensive, but they're trendy. But now at Lolo's, they're really low prices. So you get to, people get to buy a whole bag full of clothes for what they would pay for one piece at Macy's, for example.
Is that how?
It's very helpful.
Is that how you call it Lolo's?
And then they look like $1 million.
Yeah. Is that why you call it Lolo's? Because the price is so low?
No, it was named originally after my daughter, whose nickname was Lolo, and so her real name is Lauren, and so that's how it came about. And it's fun to see her. She's been living with us for a while now, and it works for me on the weekends. And it's fun to see how she's grown in that store. She's worked there since she was 13 years old, on and off. So she's it is secondarily her store.
Do you see her taking it over someday?
I don't think she's interested.
Okay, Barbara Nemco, you've been very patient. Before we got on the show, we agreed that you'd kind of be in listening mode and just jump in if you had anything. But I wanted to, because you've been so quiet, uncharacteristically so, have you ever any questions or comments in light of what you've heard so far?
It makes me think I should go downstairs to my closet and pull out some of the items that I have that I haven't worn. For example, the dress I wore to our daughter's
right?
wedding.
Exactly.
That occurred 14 or 15 years ago.
Exactly.
I have never had occasion to wear it and probably never will. It's a gorgeous dress.
And it's such a win-win. Somebody who may not have been able to afford that dress can get it. It's going to it's green, it's responsible, it's
and
keeping small local
space.
Business. You have more. Oh no, you're gonna buy more stuff. No, anyway, you're listening to work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. We're talking about what is it really like to run a consignment store? And I am talking, we are talking with Christine Waldenberg. She's the author of Lolo's, a St. Helena's women's clothing consignment shop that also sells a little furniture and other stuff, but mainly women's clothes.
And we have stuff for guys, too. We don't forget them. It's a small corner, but, you know.
Okay.
It's fair. There.
All right. Okay. Are there any secrets to getting good merchandise?
Well, you have to be in a good community for it. I mean, you have to know that there's good stuff around you. And then when it comes to you, you have to be extra ultra picky, because if you just take anything and everything, then you cheapen the good stuff by taking the junky stuff. So everything is with a fine-tooth comb. There are no spots, stains, pulls, in style, in season. If you bring in housewares or decorative items, again, notes, chips, they have to be not super antiquey and ugly, but more contemporary, works for us. Different stores have different policies, but we've kind of honed it down as to what sells the best for us. And anything that I think is funky and fun and has a good story to tell can always be really interesting to sell. It doesn't have to be super expensive. It can be, I like to sell things from $2 to $200. It doesn't really matter. It's just if it's worthy of moving itself along.
So you really have to, because most of what you sell is women's clothes, you have to really be quite knowledgeable about what's in, what's likely to stay in, quality. So you must be a fashion horse.
Well, I wouldn't say that exactly, but
fashion,
I do have lots of
fashionista.
I've got some great employees. One or two. One has been with me for 21 years.
Wow.
The other for 10 to 12 years. So, I've got a really good backbone of people that are there, plus a few fashionistas thrown in for good balance.
There we go.
And the girls that I've had with me also, I'm super proud to say that most of them have come from the community. A lot of them I've plucked from St. Helena High School, and they've stayed with me a long time, or they've stayed with me through the high school years and beginning of college, and then they've moved on. So it's really nice to be able to have people in the community be in the store as well.
Would you recommend someone get into the consignment business now?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. I think it's a great business for good times and bad times. And having been there through the 2008-2009 period of time, and no, our sales dropped some, but they didn't hit rock bottom because there was still a need. People still had to buy things.
So
I think that if you're in the right place and you have the right stuff and you are dedicated to customer service, I think you can make it work anywhere.
So those are good general platitudes, but let's say I was your brother and I was saying, you know, I'm tired of being a career counselor, I want to open a consignment shop. What's some inside baseball? What's an inside tip you might give me that I might not otherwise know?
Well, it seems obvious, but you have to sell what you like, because if it is or what you're really knowledgeable about, because then you have a passion, and if you don't have a passion, it's not going to work, because you're dealing with stuff that isn't new necessarily, and it isn't really old, but it's got value that it's an artificial value that you've placed on it. So you have to be able to be there to sell it and to or present it and know that it's a good value. So it's not so much insider, it's just common sense that you're going to do a better job with something that you are passionate about.
Is there an inch? I mean, I know they sell, there's car lots that sell an assignment, there's furniture, there's clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Is there, children's especially, because kids outgrow stuff so fast, so the stuff's virtually new when it's available for consignment. Is there a niche that I might not have thought about that you think now, in 2019, would be a particularly promising one in the consignment world?
Oh, geez, that's a good question. Nothing new springs to mind, except that I think if you appeal to, you've got to appeal not so much to a niche, and if you do appeal to a niche, then take that online as well, so that you can reach a really big audience.
Yep.
Otherwise, you have to have your merchandise hit the biggest audience that you can.
Barbara Nemco.
So we do the best with brands that are sportswear brands, not necessarily super high-end. It isn't all the Chanels or the Louis Vuittons that we've stayed in business with, but it's the Ann Taylor, Gap, Banana Republic, mainstream brands that everybody knows that they have done the advertising for us, so that people know those and they feel comfortable buying them.
I think in my almost 30 years doing the show, this particular segment was the best example of why it's better to have somebody in studio, because every time I think you're finished, I start talking and then you're not done yet. I think probably 8 times I have interrupted you when I thought you were done. Barbara Nemco, would you please save me here? You're in the same room with Christine. Would you please ask her a final question of any sort or make a comment?
Wow. Do you have a lot of customers who both buy and sell in your store?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Because also we have an incentive. If you sell something, you get more in trade than you do in cash.
Interesting. I'm feeling very motivated
go
down to my closet because you talked about the emotional reaction, and I think I'm holding onto a lot of things that I know I'm never going to use. And right now I'm feeling emotionally drawn to letting someone else use it because they're great things. They just don't fit into my life right now.
Right.
Hey, Barb, you know, negotiate a good deal, though. Don't take that 50-50 split. Try to get 60-40 out of her.
No, I'm going to get more in trade than what I'm getting.
Oh, no. That's all you need is more. Anyway, Christine Waldenberg, I should let our listeners know, you can go to lolosconsignment.com. I'm going to spell that. To get more information on the address and what they sell and what they buy and what the commission splits are and all the rest of it, LOLOS, Lolos, no apostrophe, Lolos Consignment. You know how to spell consignment. You're an intelligent audience, so I'm not going to spell it for you. LolosConsignment.com. Christine Waldenberg, thanks so much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco.
My pleasure. I appreciate it.
Barb, stay on the line. I got more to torture you with.
Oh, good.
I want to talk about time. You know, you are not time conscious. Unfortunately, for better or worse, I'm a type A and you're a type B. So I'm extremely time conscious and you're not. And so for me to hold forth with my best ideas about time management would be a little probably not useful enough to the listeners who are more normal than I am. But since you are more normal, I want to trot out my best thoughts on time management. And you can interrupt at any point, of course, and either disagree, amplify, ask me a question, or whatever. How's that sound?
I will be happy to interrupt at any time.
Right. Again, you do have experience with that. I couldn't believe how many times I interrupted poor Christine. I was sure she was done, and then she would wait like a second, then she would continue on.
She didn't feel that she was interrupted.
Well, I'm sensitive to it. Anyway.
Or you're imagining it.
Anyway, effective time management. Normally people just give a bunch of tactics. It requires you to consider 3 things: caring enough, being aware of enough of time, and using the most potent tactics to be efficient. And I'm going to take those, I'm going to talk for about a minute on each of those, on caring enough, about a minute on becoming more aware of time, and then a couple of minutes on tactics, but certainly interrupt anywhere along the way. So many people who claim to have poor time management skills have an underlying problem. They don't believe it's worth the effort to manage their time better. And ironically, of course, managing time well is crucial to improving your life enough to feel it's worth the effort. If you're unemployed, it could well be, at least in part, because you've managed your work time poorly, whether you've been playing on the net, on company time, you've been taking sick days when you're not sick, or you've been inefficient on how you tackled your work tasks. If you have poor relationships, it may be because you spend too much time with people who are unworthy of your time and too little time with people who are more worthy of your time. So it's critical ongoing before you give up and say, my life is not worth managing my time well. It's worth asking yourself, what is an efficient thing I could do now? And that can be crucial to improving your life, including your motivation to even better manage your time, because success then breeds more success. Any reaction to that? I should go on.
I do have a reaction.
Good.
I think that time management is one of those skills that people don't realize they need to be taught. You go to school and they teach you how to read and how to write and how to do math, but they don't really teach you how to manage time.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of assumed that you're going to pick that up through osmosis or your parents or your household.
Right.
And if it's not even in your consciousness mm-hmm. that time is a commodity that needs managing, it's very easy to be distracted. So one of the new things that they do in schools these days is they have a program called AVID that tries to teach kids all these things that are not subjects and yet are crucial to success. And time management, I believe, is one of them.
Okay. I want to go on and talk about it. I'm going to get to awareness of time in a minute or two. I'm going to get to tactics in a minute or two. But I don't want to give short shrift to what I think are the prerequisites. Before we get to the tactics, you got to care enough. And there is another reason, you know, as the first reason I mentioned was that, you know, your life is in the toilet and you don't feel it's worth the effort to manage your time well. But another reason that people don't care to manage time well is that they feel it won't make enough of a difference to others. I mean, even the impact of presidents is limited. But life's meaning resides, at least primarily, in making as big a difference as we can within our sphere of influence, at least. And for a person with a small sphere, that could be as basic as being kind to as many people as possible when you feel it's worth the effort. For other people, it might be working long hours, using their best skills in the service of making a big difference. And by the way, that needn't mean helping people with the greatest deficit. The good time manager focuses on helping people with the most potential to profit, or on tasks that build or disseminate products that are really worthy or services that are really worthy. Any comment there, or should I go on?
None of that resonated with me at this particular moment.
Okay. Go ahead.
There needs to be a reason. So people may suddenly realize that they're not managing their time well when they have tasks at work that they're supposed to accomplish and they're not accomplishing them in the time allotted. So that's a kind of wake-up call.
Sure.
That how did I spend 10 hours when I was only given 5 hours and I'm still not done.
True. All right, I want to turn now to the people you were alluding to earlier. They're just not intrinsically aware of time. Some of those people wonder where the hour went, where the day went, even where their life went.
Mm-hmm.
And these tactics can help. The very simplest, it sounds simplistic, and it probably is to simply write on your palm the word time. That's going to at least help keep you aware because you're going to see it all day. And if that's too simple, try setting the timer on your phone or a small kitchen timer that you would keep with you during the day. And you set the timer, say, for 30 minutes. And every time it chimes, that's a reminder to be aware of how you're spending your time. You might even use your phone's notepad or an old-fashioned memo pad to jot down what you were doing each time the timer chimed. And at the end of the day, maybe even reviewing it to see if you want to change anything about how you use your time the next day or even that evening. Any reaction to that?
Yeah, that makes some sense. I'm trying to think why you would suddenly have this urge to be setting timers. I mean, there's got to be a precipitating incident about what you're not doing.
Well, it can often be, you know, it's like an alcoholic who reaches rock bottom and they say, you know what, I'm looking at how I've wasted away my life or I got fired. You know, when somebody gets fired, and they say, you know, you just haven't been productive enough, you know, or they may, you know, the employer generally doesn't give a very candid answer, but they look inward and they say, you know, when I compare myself with my peers, somehow how did he or she get so much done and I got so little? So sometimes, yes, it's a precipitating incident.
Yeah, that's a precipitating incident.
But sometimes it's simply, you know, you just, one day you say, you know, and I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired of my status quo. But yes, I don't disagree with you. I want to talk a little bit about another way of becoming more aware of your time. Many people underestimate the amount of time that a task is going to take. And you and I have talked about this a lot. There's only one way that a task can work out perfectly and an infinite number of ways it could take longer. And that's why, you know, a smart tradesperson would appropriately add maybe 25%, you know, a fudge factor to the amount of time they think the project's going to take. And so if you, dear listener, tend to underestimate the amount of time you're always running behind,
mm-hmm.
force yourself to add 25%.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If you're feeling that there's something wrong.
But the problem is that sometimes people do that because they just love the idea of cramming as much into a life as possible, or they simply like the adrenaline rush of trying to cram too much into a small amount of time.
That would be me.
Right. And so is that really fixable? You know, can you, you know, say, you know, I'm going to stop my adrenaline addiction or I'm going to limit it to scary movies and riding roller coasters and playing competitive sports? Or, you know, is there a way to address that adrenaline rush and the desire to cram as much into your life as possible?
Well, I don't like scary movies and probably not going to join any sports teams at this time. So my adrenaline rush does come from trying to cram in everything and having every minute filled because I've overscheduled by 25 or 35% what I should be trying to do in a day.
And are you paid a price for that, or you managed to get close enough to getting it done on time that, you know, it's worth the trying to cram in, and maybe you benefit net, because I feel I do.
Yeah, I think I enjoy that.
Okay.
I enjoy that feeling of, wow, I did it all.
Me too. All right, I want to turn to tactics, and I want to get your reaction to each of these. And you tell me if this is just, you know, again, every how-to writer or how-to radio talk show host is guilty too often of assuming that if it makes sense to him or her, it's going to make sense to the audience. And so I need you as a normal person with normal sense of time value to tell me I'm full of it or to agree or whatever. The thing that has helped me more in my entire life to be time effective is what I call the voice. It's having a little voice in my ear, ever asking myself, is this a good use of my time? That is, anyway, what do you think about that one?
I'd kill myself.
All right, I'm about 0-6 with you. I don't think I've said a single word other than welcome to the show, Barbara.
What else is
that,
true?
That you've liked. Okay, let me try another
Happy
one.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Exactly. You know what I should do? I should probably give out the phone number. Does anybody have a time management problem or a solution that a problem they'd like to share and get my obviously inept, my inept advice and perhaps Barbara's wiser advice on how to address your time management problem? I guess that's the only reason I want you to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty, or your suggestion. Yeah, either your question.
Well,
or
they have a story about what worked. They had a problem. What worked?
Exactly. The question or the suggestion. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Okay. Now here's the next tactic for you to knock down. I call it the gas pedal. Sometimes, in terms of your time, you want to, in terms of a task, you want to proceed on cruise control. That is, you either delegate to someone, or importantly, you decide, I'm not going to do this task when I've got something better to do or something wiser to do. Sometimes you want to press the pedal lightly. That is, go slowly, doing the task carefully. Sometimes you want to press moderately. That's your default. And sometimes you want to go pedal to the metal, you know, where going fast imposes little risk of crashing. And that, keeping that metaphor in mind, instead of being one size, one speed fits all the time, you can become more efficient by thinking about that gas pedal. Do you think that's stupid, or you think it's good, truthfully?
I wouldn't say it's stupid. It's not in my skill set to operate that way. My speed and my thought about time would vary because of a specific task that had a deadline. So if somebody says you have to get this proposal done by 2 o'clock tomorrow, then I'm going to really move because I know what I have to do. Given that I don't have a deadline for that, I'm not going to be speeding along, and I'm certainly not going to stop all day long asking myself, was that the best use of the last 10 minutes?
Well, dear listeners, there's one thing you cannot accuse this show of. It's just a lack of diversity. I am saying A, she says B. I say B, she says A. So let's just go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty and Barbara. What is either your question about time management or your suggestion about time management?
Yes, hi. I'm in a relatively new job, and I have various different things to do. I have to read a lot. I have to learn the software. I have to actually work, and so on. And I don't know how to distribute my time between them. I seem to get bogged with just reading or just playing with the software or whatever. Is there a good way? Should I switch back and forth? How do I approach that?
There's a few factors that can be taken. First of all, sometimes you can make in terms of reading. Sometimes, again, you do have to read it all really slowly or carefully. I don't care if Barbara disagrees with my gas pedal metaphor. But sometimes, as anybody who's ever taken a college course who's gotten a reading assignment, reading list of, 3,000 pages they have to read as though that was the only course a student was taking, you may ask yourself, as you're reading, say, can I skim this? Can I skip this? Do I need to read this carefully? And even more carefully is reading it and then turning away and then trying to summarize it while turning away. That's a really good way to really remember something important. So do you? So one tactic is to choose a different speed for each of those tasks. And two is simply when you're new on a job, it's expected, if you're a good employee, that there is a ramp-up period. And in that ramp-up period, nearly everyone works longer. But my tip for you is this. If normally you're expecting to work 40 and you're not getting it all done in 40, even if you're trying to be efficient about it, doing kind of the priorities that your boss has laid out for you and varying the speed at which you do these things, don't put the additional time in at work. Why? Because if you're putting in 50 hours during the first few weeks while you're ramping up, and then scale back to 40, there's an unconscious message you may be sending that you're being a bit of a slacker. So do the extra 10 hours at home to the extent you can. Is any of that helpful to you?
Yes, all of it. And should I, is it after an hour, does your brain sort of fatigue?
Great question.
Should you go to something else?
I love it. It really, everything is variable. I love the word nuance. It's one of my favorite words. Sometimes if it's hard or boring crap, you're done in 10 minutes. You need to walk around for 5 minutes. Sometimes if you're into it, you can go an hour and a half. Now, we all know that sitting is the new smoking, so I don't want you sitting in the chair for 2 hours in a row. But certainly somewhere within the 5 minutes to hour and a half, trust your body. Trust your mind. If you're just saying, oh, I hate this, I've got to take a break, then either take a break or change things. Trust your body. I teach in the medical school at UCSF, and I, much as they've learned about medicine, in the end, I really believe in trusting one's body to a reasonable extent. So when you're feeling like, oh, I'm feeling itchy, I got to honor that. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much.
Barbara.
And happy Valentine's Day to you both.
You too. See, Barbara, all I need to do is go to somebody else and I get immediate agreement. With you, yeah, I'm zero for 9 zillion.
Well, that's the Lifetime Achievement Award.
You're right. I'm zero, right. Zero. That's what you should give me as a plaque for my Lifetime Achievement, a big zero on a plaque. Anyway.
See, I think the way I would approach that, what I think I heard her say was she's in a new job and sometimes she has to read some things and learn some software. And I would approach it as what do I have to learn from this reading? What is my question about this? Do I need to know all the theory of it or do I just need to know how to do something? And then I would skim it for just the part that I thought I needed to take away, and I would read that and say, do I understand that? And if it was something about how to use the software, then I would try it and see if I got it right.
Yeah, there's no question that trying to learn something in context, if you've got to use the software, nobody needs to use, in general, very few, need to use all the software's features. So if you learn the piece of the software on a need-to-know basis with a concrete little project, and then when you get stuck, using what I call the Hey Joe school, turning to somebody in your cube farm who knows the thing and getting a just-in-time, in-context answer can be a way to keep from getting bored. You're not just staring and going through it, plowing through it from start to finish. Does that make sense?
I'm going to shock you. I totally agree with that.
Because I was agreeing with your point.
Oh, well, that could be why.
We've only got a couple of minutes. Here's another tip which you're going to disagree with, no doubt. Multitasking has, in my mind, acquired an undeserved bad rap. I mean, even top surgeons chatter and or listen to music while they're cutting people open. And often multitasking is pleasant, efficient, and yes, that adrenaline rush we were talking about. Like, as you know, Barbara, most days I take a hike with my doggy Einstein to Trader Joe's. That's about 3/4 mile away. I bring my thorniest problem that I need to think about. I'm jotting notes on my flip note. It's like a really cool memo pad that I love. And meanwhile, Einstein and I are getting our exercise, both of us, and he's relieving himself. And I get my shopping done, and with a lot of vigorous exercise, could come back with a 20-pound bags, two bags of groceries. So that's like 5 multitaskings, and I think that's fabulous. Most people, they recoil at the notion of multitasking. Your thoughts, Barbara?
I disagree with your definition of multitasking. Clearly, taking a walk while thinking is not multitasking. Multitasking is when you are reading something, but at the same time you're talking on the phone. And you think, well, I'm multitasking, but you're not. You're switching your concentration back and forth between the two things because you can't really multitask that way. And you're very likely to screw something up, either what you say on the phone or what you thought you read.
Again, I think nuance is required. There are sometimes, for example, you're on the phone. And I don't mean just when you're on hold, but you're ending up listening to somebody and you really do know what they're saying. And you're bored to tears, but you don't want to interrupt them. So you're doing a little reading of what you've got on your screen at the same time. I don't
but
think
that's okay, as long as there's no information that you need to be getting.
Well,
again, that's not multitasking. That's tuning that person out pretty much. They're talking and you don't really care.
Your definition of multitasking is bizarre. Nobody makes thinking decisions two at the same time. That's impossible. Multitasking is when you're doing things where there are lots of little breaks, little sponge times that you have time to fill it in. And that was my last point, by the way. We have a ton of sponge time. And you better not disagree with this.
Or
I'll take back my Valentine's Day flowers. we all have dead time. We're
give them back to Safeway?
No, Trader Joe's.
excuse me.
They're still looking good, right?
You can multitask. You can carry the flowers back to Trader Joe's. I
hope they bend over and wilt on you. Anyway, we all do have dead time. We're driving or on mass transit or waiting for a meeting or doctor's appointments or for the car at the Jiffy Lube. Now, do you disagree that we should sponge up that dead time a lot of the time? Bring the audiobook, the Kindle.
Most people do that. They'll pull out their phone and do their email.
But a lot of people don't. They just get annoyed at the delay. I mean, in a car when I'm driving up to Napa in the ridiculous traffic, or when I'm driving here, I'm always reading an audiobook. I am multitasking. I'm sponging up the dead time. So you agree with that?
Well, I always listen to audiobooks in the car, and I think I'm treating myself. I don't think of it as multitasking. I just think of it as making the unpleasant job of having to travel and be in traffic very pleasant by listening to something I want to hear.
I think any relationship counselor listening to this would assume that we have long been divorced on this Valentine's Day. But in any case, we are out of time, thank God, out of time in this time management show. So I don't know if I should thank you or curse you, Barbara Nemco, for being my goad on this edition of Work with Marty Nemco.
Anyway, always my pleasure.
Yeah, I know. You do seem to get particular pleasure out of giving me barbs. You should be a bandoliera like in the bullfights. Okay, anyway, my thanks to my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. I'll try to help you with a work problem. Plus, Beverly Olbrich on what it's really like to be a dog trainer. Until then, this is Marty Nemco for Barbara Nemco, the miserable wife of mine of 40 years. Anyway, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.